Okay, thanks. Morning, the Senate E-12 Budget Division will come to order. Today's Tuesday, February 17, 2015. The first item on the agenda is a Department of Education report on career and technical education. And welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Mr. Chair.
Good morning.
Steve Dibb, Deputy Commissioner at the Department of Education. I'd like to thank the committee for inviting us to talk a little bit about the inventory that was completed recently on career technical education program inventory. Mr. Chair and committee members, again, as a reminder, this inventory was a result of session law from 2014, the purpose of which was to gain an understanding of the scope of the available 9th through 12th grade CTE courses, student participation in these courses, and the breadth of equipment resources available. A very wide-sweeping inventory and a lot of information, a lot of data gathered to create this report. And if you recall, the report was to be submitted to the legislature, which it was a few weeks ago. The Office of College and or Career and College Support from the department took this task on. Had to find some other resources in order to do this inventory. Like I said, it was quite broad, quite deep in its scope. And with me today to help explain this is Paula Palmer, who is the Director of Career and College Success at the Department of Education. I'll turn it over to her to talk to you a little bit about the methodology they use and then some of the key findings, which of course was the whole gist of the inventory to inform you of what the state of career technical education is. Paula?
Good morning, Chairman Wieger and Senators. The methodology that we used for this required that we definitely decide who the stakeholders are in this process, because we knew that that was key to getting the right information and getting it in a timely manner. We defined terminology, as you know, we throw a lot of terms around there, and because we were asking our constituents to provide us information, we wanted to make sure that we had clear and concise terminology so that the requests matched the pieces of information that were submitted. And we decided to use a two-pronged inventory approach. One was a part was a survey where we preloaded some data sets with information regarding equipment, typical equipment uses or typical equipment lists, as well as what we had at the department as far as approved career and technical education courses. So we tried to pre-populate the information as much as possible for ease of the districts, and then communicated in multiple ways with superintendents and key stakeholders around career and technical education. All public, independent, special, intermediate, integration, cooperatives, service, vocational cooperatives, and charters were invited to participate in this survey process. So again, we had a two-part piece where the first part was about course inventory as per the legislative language, and then the equipment and facilities that were supporting both the secondary schools. But also the request was to try to find out what kinds of secondary, post-secondary partnerships were in place in the state of Minnesota. So just for clarity purposes, there are two different kinds of CTE courses as defined by districts. There are approved career and technical education courses that have gone through an approval process via initiated from the districts, where there's a requirement that there be a licensed CTE teacher teaching that course, as well as that course being a part of a program of study or a series of courses that reflect a pathway pathway development in career and tech ed. And then districts do offer other CTE courses that have not necessarily gone through the approval process, Our inventory encompassed both of those, but differentiated between the two when we analyzed and reported out the data. Some of our key findings, we'll start with the most common career cluster program areas offered. At least 50% of the districts who responded, and we had a significant number and a valid number of districts responding to this to be able to establish statistical validity in the results. We needed 47.4% roughly 47% of the districts responding. And in the two parts, we had 60% responding in one part and 64% responding in another part. And you can look into the report for more details where we list specifically which districts did respond and where they lay around the district, around the state. But at least 50% of those districts that responded, the career cluster areas that were most frequently offered in the state, for example, is family and consumer science. So 69.4% of the districts said that they had that program in their area, in their district, and you can read the rest of those business management, architecture and construction, and agriculture and food and natural resources were the top most frequently offered career cluster areas.
Mr. Chair, I'm just going to also ask Ms. Palmer to, we'll move through the data slides very quickly just because there is a lot of data. You want to jot down some questions. We'd like to leave some time at the end of our presentation for those questions. And, of course, if you need some light evening reading, the complete report is there also with much more detail, as Ms. Palmer said.
And color-coded pictures. Makes it very entertaining.
Thank you.
The highest number of courses offered within CLEAR cluster program areas, we took a look at that. And if you look, you can see those data points there. So the most commonly offered courses within those CLEAR career cluster areas are, as you can see, for example, business management and admin is number one. Again, family, consumer science, ag, and architecture and construction being the top most offered courses. Some more key key findings that we found in the course inventory percentages is that the highest percentage of courses offered fully online, we wanted to take a look at those, is career exploration, followed by business, and then IT. Again, business management and administration is noteworthy as the highest number of partially or fully online courses. So across the state, there are 144 of those. And some courses that offer academic credits, this is something that is, definitely districts are looking at, is how can we offer academic credit towards graduation within those career and technical education courses, business and management and admin around the state. There are 1,752 of those districts that are offering some kind of academic credit towards graduation within their career and tech ed courses, and then you can see FACS and then AG is shortly followed that. Percentages of districts with post-secondary and or business and industry and community org advisories, we do require within the Perkins Consortium model, which is how we distribute the Perkins federal funding, which is a partnership between secondary and post-secondary, so MDE and MNSCU are the fiscal hosts of those dollars. And within that, we have created 26 consortium, and the money flows that through those consortium. And we require that each one of those consortium has an advisory with community and business and industry experts as a part of that, helping guide the programming and the leadership of those activities using those federal dollars. And you can see that this is a very relative percentage. For example, public affairs and community awareness, 100% of those have advisories, and business management and administrative support have advisories, but there are only a handful of public affairs and community awareness programs, whereas there's far more, as you can see, business management and administrative support. So those percentages are very relative to the numbers of programs that there are actually. And then post-secondary relationships, where there are articulation agreements where a student can take that course in secondary school, and that they, if they go to their partnering post-secondary institution, they will be able to take those credits with them for the majority of the career cluster program areas. There are 20 to 40% of their courses that they offer have such type of articulation agreements. Another key finding is when we looked at the work-based learning, and these are registered, approved programs when we say this, so we use the capital letters, official work-based learning programs, youth apprenticeship programs, handicap transition and disabled programs. Approximately 8% of all 9th through 12th grade students in Minnesota are enrolled in some sort of one of those three programs. When we take a look at the equipment, I thought, sorry, is Siri going to help out here? when we get to the equipment inventory portion of this, this is very noteworthy that when we looked at the equipment, this was kind of a big beast to attack because when you think of equipment, it can range anywhere from $5 to thousands, tens of thousands of dollars. So just for consistency's sake, we ask that they report, the districts report on anything valued $400 or more. But then again, know that there's quite a range after the $400 mark. So the districts identified 58,000 pieces of equipment, and districts reported that within those numbers, anywhere from 0 to 12% of their equipment is provided in kind or donated. And when they were asked, what do you need to be able to sustain and grow your program, the districts reported that there were another 18,860 pieces of equipment needed. And if we conservatively would calculate out that cost at $400, the very minimum, that's another $7 million worth of equipment they have reported statewide that they would need. And even within that, we asked them, what pieces of your equipment meet industry standards? 59.2% of them said that their existing equipment meets industry standards. And again, this is a very relative statistic because these percentages do not convey the relative importance. So, for example, as a teacher, I may say I need a cart, but I also need a flywheel remover, which is something that's used in the automotive area. So that does not relate to the priority nor the cost when they say how much more they would need to meet that industry standard. And so basically when we looked at the data, it looks as though based on who responded to the survey and the inventory, that programs are operating at approximately 75% of their actual capacity to serve students based on available equipment. And when we looked at facilities, so for example, the right size of the shop for the type of activity that they would be doing in their career tech ed program to ventilation systems needed, or the right setup for example, welding booths. most career areas reported needing updates within the next 2 to 5 years, again, to sustain and grow their programs. And districts needing updates for career areas within the next year. Some said none of them needed updates. Up to 32% of them reported needing updates. And again, these statistics, law enforcement said we don't really need anything, but when you think about that, they probably don't need any special facilities to do their program, versus manufacturing would need very specialized facilities to do their program, and 32% of those said that they needed updates in the next 2 to 5 years. We took the opportunity to then also ask districts to open-endedly report what they felt were self-identified barriers to sustaining and increasing CTE participation, and these are listed as the main themes. We clustered their comments into main themes, and of course, we've pretty much covered the funding aspect of that. But the other very top reported barriers, self-perceived self-reported barriers, were simply the lack of licensed CTE teachers. The supply does not meet the demand, and therefore districts, if they want to offer these CTE programs and receive Carl Perkins funds, as well as the state revenue reimbursement that they can receive with licensed teachers and approved programs, they do not have enough to run their programs. And many districts are saying that they are having to drop programs, in fact, because they are just running short of teachers being able to teach those courses. And then, of course, the equipment, the lack of equipment availability and facilities. And then the next two are pretty much very interconnected. The student school day, the lack of flexibility within the student school day. Let's say you have a 7-period day or a 6-period day in your district. Because of all the academic requirements for graduation, leaves very little elective, a room for students to take courses such as CTE, and they often need to choose between either taking band or music or career tech ed or some other advanced course like IB or AP or some kind of concurrent enrollment. So that is one of the things that creates a barrier, as well as flexibility within the student day and or choice options. So there's also, this was not collected necessarily, but we know via other data that there are not always the same options for dual credit and CTE in all districts across the state. Again, you know, all of this is very interconnected with licensure and funding, et cetera. And then, again, the other two, you can read staff capacity, just that staff capacity to actually run these kinds of programs and fulfill the fiscal and the grant requirement kinds of activities that take time and staff capacity to do. And then there were other open-ended responses, which are included in the report.
So before Ms. Palmer's voice gives out here, we'll put more information up here. We'd like to mention also one of her staff members, Carrie Ann Ettinger, is here also. Carrie Ann pretty much took on the role of the logistics of the inventory, collecting the data, putting the data into a form where it was able to be put into a report. And under the supervision of Michelle Kavanaugh, supervisor in the CTE area, they were able to rally their troops. And it literally was a total division, plus a few more people. We had great help from Government Relations Assistant Director Stephen Huser to put the report together. Rose Hermanson also helped with the report. So required quite a bit of manpower. But I think, again, for the scope of the inventory, you'll find it very data rich and hopefully will inform your decision making as we move forward. At this time, we might have some time for some questions that we would entertain, Mr. Chair.
Yes, thank you for the overview on the inventory. Senator Stump.
thank you, Mr. Chairman. Two points or questions. One is related to the teacher supply, and it's where does the teacher shortage actually come from? I've heard that part of the problem is in the higher education institutions in terms of where you can get that that CTE licensing certification. And I'm wondering why that has cropped up as a problem, and what can we do about it? The other question relates to the student school day, and this is maybe just a point. The other day in this committee, we heard from a superintendent in southern Minnesota about how we might address CTE participation, and one of it is the possibility of using the summer months through possibly extended day funding or some mechanism that we could take advantage of that time period for delivering those kinds of programs, and they'd be quite appropriate because I think it would be long enough to have a full-fledged program. Many of them fit in, like the ag programs fit in with the summer months, and some of the other programs as well.
Thank you, Senator Stump.
Licensure and schedule flexibility.
All right.
So, Senator Stump, thank you for that question. They are very interrelated. We've really looked really hard in the last year or so at really what it is that's, you know, what are the elements that are kind of leading to this issue of the teacher supply challenge. And it's multiply pronged. One of the things that we see is there just are not enough folks going into the field for a variety of reasons. So anecdotally, I can give you a story of particularly in ag, we educate these folks really well, but then sometimes they get swept away by industry as soon as they're ready to launch into the field, and or we are not able to offer attractive enough working contracts for folks to compete with those kinds of that kind of competition. So, for example, your idea of the extended student day piece or student year piece and leveraging maybe some existing funding mechanisms that we have to create that would probably help the situation. We also have some significant gaps in what we even have within Minnesota as far as teacher preparation. As some of you may know, the University of Minnesota, who was one of our CTE teacher prep institutions, has sunsetted their CTE programs. They do still do the agriculture under a different department, but the rest of them are sunsetted. And currently, we have no medical occupations, medical field teacher prep. We do not have IT prep in the state of Minnesota. So that's part of the issue, as well as in greater Minnesota, it's reported that access to those programs and affordability to those programs is a challenge for our teachers to be able to even partake and participate in those programs. So we've definitely been in conversations with anyone that we can have an opportunity to talk about. Are there ways that we can create more mobile, rich, or online, blended online, accessible programming, as well as build up and scale up the programming that we do need to meet our workforce development and CTE pathways in our district, so in our state. So there are many reasons that this is happening. I think that there's also a need at this point in time to be thinking of various on-ramps, so maybe leveraging some of our very talented, motivated, existing licensed teachers to add that career and technical education piece on. We've been working with the licensing department and the Board of Teaching, and they are looking at providing a little more flexibility in some of the variances that teachers are on right now. They're not fully licensed, but they're teaching within a variance circumstance. So maybe in the meantime, being more flexible with extending those variances might help some of that teacher shortage issue. But it's very much of a pipeline issue. So if we don't have folks going into the field, teaching the students, creating more future teachers, then it just kind of cycles back to creating, partly contributing to this shortage.
Thank you.
And Mr. Chair, in terms of the extended funding, it certainly creates opportunities and possibilities for schools. And I think, Senator Stump, the area that we've heard most from is the agricultural area, to be able to carry students through from their regular school year into the summer months through some form of extended CTE funding. Not to be confused with extended funding, say, for alternative programs that carry alternative programs throughout the summer, which, again, there could be an intersection between the alternative programming and the CTE program, certainly. Again, these programs would have to be part of an approved CTE program and by the state. So I think there's possibilities, but there's also some challenges putting that together as well. I mean, funding is one of those, but also some of the mechanics behind the type of categorical funding that would go with that, and how districts could use those funds. So certainly possible, but not without its challenges as well.
Noting the quote on the report, "Leading for educational excellence and equity every day for everyone," might we expect a recommendation from the department in addition to the inventory on how we accomplish the identified needs?
Mr. Chair, I think the P20 report that came out recently does address some of the supply and demand issues and school day issues and so forth. And I guess at this point, I would say that we certainly, based on both data gathered here and anecdotally from our consortium members, we certainly could put out some recommendations if that would be the will of the committee to do so. Again, this is an area that Ms. Palmer and her staff work in every single day, and they hear it from everyone. And I think as you read our mission statement, Mr. Chair, the equity part is where we really feel strongly we need to make sure that this is accessible to every student in the state of Minnesota. And we have some wonderful programs, but they're kind of islands of success around the state. And we want to make sure that every student, whether in the northwest corner, northeast, southwest, have equal access to a certified CTE teacher, to programming that allows them to get the training that they need and be prepared to enter the workforce. And that's the steep challenge that we're faced with in terms of career technical education. The good news is there's a lot of interest in this area and working together with concurrent enrollment options through MNSCU and other university partners. A lot of positive steps are moving forward. But they, you know, these wheels grind slowly, and again, it comes back to a number of challenges that districts identify that they have in front of them to really make this kind of border-to-border programming.
Okay. Chairman Weger, may I add something to that about your question about the equity? Thank you. There's a lot of our experts in the field have really laid a compelling plan idea, and that is part of the equity issue is the opportunity gap. So our new legislative requirement, that 120B-125, that requires the student plan, and a part of that is an element around experiential learning. And there's very strong sentiment in the field that by reaching down into the younger grades as well to create more of those experiential learning opportunities so that students can actually see how what they're learning in school fits the schematic of their future and the future workforce needs, that is a key piece of creating that equity by creating more opportunity for more students to explore careers and be able to have those experiences in extended time, like summertime and after school time.
Thank you. Senator Jensen, followed by Senators Pratt and Kiffmeyer and Clausen, will probably go to about 10 after or so, recognizing we have many persons here from Greater Minnesota for subsequent bills. So, but we will be visiting this topic a couple of more times for sure. Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Jensen. Chair. And I was a little late, but I just want to make sure I understand that 50% of the schools, is that what percentage of the schools participated in the survey?
60% in, carry on, I'm going to look over, 60% in part one, 65 in part one, 60% in part one, which is around the courses, and the facilities and equipment, 65% participated.
Okay, Mr. Chair. So, and I am one that is very interested and have been waiting for this report, so thank you for your work on this. When I go to look at the full report and go through it, is there some geographic information within
yes.
that report? Okay, thank you.
Yes.
Good. Well, again, we will be following up on this. Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Palmer, one of the things I'm thinking of is career and technical education has changed over the years. And I'm looking, you know, kind of at your high-level descriptions, but I'm thinking about some of the innovation I've seen, robotics. Senator Jensen and I were just talking yesterday about IT academies and computer programming. I'm starting to hear that we've got school districts developing fabrication or manufacturing labs. Are those also being included in CTE, or do we need to look at modifying that definition, or is it appropriate to modify that definition? Ms. Palmer?
Thank you, Chairman and Senators. Yes and yes and no. Yes, those are included. If a district does apply to have an approved program and that course is a part of that approved course or program, yes, it would be included in CTE and then eligible for both Perkins funding as well as the state funding. However, I think that we are definitely interested in looking at maybe there are some areas that we are not necessarily even having we even have licenses for because of the innovation and some of the new technologies. Maybe we need to be looking at what else we should be building because it's rapidly changing, just the drones. Mm-hmm. I mean, we do have students who are engaged in learning about that. In fact, we were just at an expo where in agriculture they were demonstrating how they use drone technology to help with the farming pieces of their field. So, yes, it is included, but I believe that we definitely would need business and industry expertise to help us refine. Are we really creating the pathways, or do we need to refine some of the pathways or revitalize them or create new pathways?
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Kiffmeyer, and I believe you have a very good perspective on drones as well.
Yes, right. Yes, we did. And right, Senator Stump?
That's correct.
We got to see them going, so that was really good. No, I think one of the things that I think is really important to recognize here when you talk about the fact that they're innovating locally almost so rapidly, and one of the problems I have is by the time we get an MDE program, it's going to be obsolete. Because there's movement. And one of the best things we can do is allow them the flexibility down here. And that's one of their things, given the flexibility to do it. And so that every school is not the same. So when we toured Millwright, I never heard of a Millwright before, but up in Grand Rapids, in their career technical area, it's a big deal for the mines. I would never think of mining being a millwright. I thought it would be maybe a construction thing, but it isn't. But they know their need, and they worked with their local businesses to get equipment, and they did a lot of wonderful things. And one of the things that I want to clarify then, though, is when you're talking about teacher supply, are you referring to teacher supply within a high school or a shared teacher between a high school and a career technical type of college?
Senators and Chairman, it could be both. There are a few instances where we do have some teachers that are credentialed at the post-secondary level as well as licensed at the secondary level, and they do, in Faribault, I know, for example, they have a teacher who does that. But most of the cases, this inventory would be inclusive of purely secondary teachers, grades 9 through 12, who are teaching in the CTE areas.
Mr. Kiffmeyer. Yeah, and so is your shortage then in regards through that when you're talking about your teacher supply, is that having to do with 9th through 12th grade? That's what you're referring to?
Yes, Chairman and Senators, yes. This inventory reflects the teacher shortage as well as the reported barriers are mostly 9 through 12.
And a follow-up question?
One more.
And so if you're thank you. And so do you have teachers in the post-secondary that could be helpful in the 9-12 if they were just double certified?
Ms. Palmer.
They're licensed. It also comes down to, Senator Kiffmeyer, also comes down to teacher licensure in public schools, and most post-secondary instructors are not licensed to teach in the state of Minnesota in a K-12 license. Again, I think there are opportunities for further conversations with our institutions of higher ed to blur that line between high school and post-secondary. Those conversations are in place, but you know, again, we would need the partnership with that institution of higher learning as well. I think the other question that you had was about kind of just that gross supply and demand. And last week, there was a conversation here in the legislature around agriculture, teachers and agricultural programs. And that's one area that we just see a plain old lack of bodies in the state of Minnesota that are teaching ag in any way, shape, or form. We some of those programs that Ms. Palmer talked about earlier, IT certifications, just doesn't exist in our state. Recently, I had a conversation with a superintendent from northwestern Minnesota, actually significantly large district, who's not been able to find an ag teacher in 2 years and so had to shut their program down again. Mm-hmm. So in some areas, it's outright shortage. In some areas, it's a certification issue, a Minnesota state teaching license issue. So again, there's some work that needs to be done in doing some flexibility around those certifications and licensure. I think we can have people who are really qualified in the content area that are not licensed. We have some teachers who are licensed but not having the expertise in the CTE programs. So.
May I add some more? Thank you, Chairman.
Yes,
and Senators. I just want to say that one of the reasons reported by the University of Minnesota of why they needed to sunset their program or believe they wanted to take that direction is they also were experiencing difficulty finding qualified, credentialed, post-secondary teachers for career and technical education. They had been experiencing that struggle for a number of years as well. So I think it's a big issue that spans both secondary and post-secondary.
Yeah, and we definitely have to have a follow-up and hopefully a proposal from the department and others to remedy this. We have time for a couple of more questions. Senator Claussen and Senator Dames.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just picking up again on this whole licensure issue, it's a bit of a catch-22 for schools because secondary schools, if you want to expand your program or if you want to receive state or Perkins funding, you have to have the CTE certified teachers. And we're finding out there's no place in Minnesota really to get that certification. I think other states are finding the same issue. Oregon, North Carolina, Ohio are all changing their licensure requirements. I don't know the last time we reviewed the CTE licensure requirements in our state, but I would maintain they're really outdated. And I think, as just been said, content area expertise is number one. I think the CTE licensure, a lot of those courses are philosophical courses about careers, career exploration, and so on. And I just question whether it's really applicable today, the licensure requirements we have. And I think we need to move quickly on this. Mm-hmm. Or we're really going to be finding ourselves, as we already are in many cases, really limiting opportunities for students in our future workforce. So that is just reiterating what's always been said, but I really think the CT licensure is outdated and we need to take a look at that. Other states are finding the same predicament. There's a reason why colleges, universities are dropping their programs. So thank you.
It will be. Senator Dames.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and it really isn't a question as much as a comment. The testifiers have talked about the shortage of agricultural teachers. I think last year there was 24 different programs that were unable to have a full-time ag teacher in their classroom, but there is some good things coming on the horizon. Southwest State and Marshall has just launched their new program for ag education, so that will be in force, so hopefully that'll help alleviate this. And I think there's probably another institution that's also looking at launching an ag education program, so hopefully in a couple of years we can fill that need.
Let's hope so. Thank you.
Again, thank you very much for the presentation. We'll be following up, as noted, with various questions on proposals.
Thank you,
Chairman.
Thanks. We have three bills, Senate File 467, Senator Stump, and you have several testifiers, and we'll ask them to join you. And that'll be followed by Senator Dahl, and finally Senator Saxhawk.
Signing of these.
Senate File 467, Northwest Mobile Manufacturing Lab Establishment. Senator Stone.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. I'll be real brief with my initial remarks, and we have a couple of testifiers that have to leave and testify over in the House at 9:30. So,
yes.
What this is about is to try to figure out how we can deliver some of the career and technical programs to a larger area that currently don't have those programs. And this is an idea of a mobile, kind of a mobile classroom. And so I think I will turn it over to Peggy Kennedy, who is the president of the Minnesota State College, Technical College at Moorhead.
Welcome, President Kennedy.
Thank you so much, Chair, Mr. Chair, and committee members. As I said, it's my privilege and pleasure to be the president of Minnesota State Community and Technical College, also known as M-State. We have campuses in Detroit Lakes, Fergus Falls, Moorhead, and Wadena. And we try to partner with our fellow two-year and four-year colleges. We try to partner with our four-year and two-year colleges, and we just wanted to express our support for this project at Northland Community and Technical College. This is not the first time that we have collaborated. I want to say that our priorities as a two-year college system are, first of all, to improve student success, meaning their access to our colleges, their persistence, their completion, and then finally their career placement and transfer rates. But a secondary goal, just as important, if not more so, is our work with the local workforce. We need to strengthen our strategies to meet the needs of those businesses and those industries. And that really requires us to be a little bit more creative and to do things a little bit differently than we do with our students who actually come to campus. And so one of the ways that we have been more creative is to develop our own mobile welding lab. And I also want to introduce Mr. G.L. Tucker, who is our dean for customized training. Our customized training program is offered to local businesses and industries on-site, on their site, on our site, and now through our mobile welding lab. I'm going to ask GL to explain that to you in a little bit more detail because we think it's really been a creative way for us to meet the needs of businesses and industries without having to come to campus. And as a president, what I love to hear about it is that it has been book solid every day since we developed it. So again, I want to express our support to Northland Community and Technical College and Senator Stump for promoting this bill. And GL, can you just explain a little bit more about our mobile welding lab and its purposes and how we serve the needs of our workforce?
Thank you. Dean Tucker.
Thank you. Thank you for having me today and having us, allowing us to testify. So appreciate your time. We developed our mobile welding trailer about a year and a half ago, a little bit over now. But we really believe that we really have to go to the students. And those students could be incumbent worker students, or they could be students through the workforce centers. We've worked with all those, and we've also done some work with area high schools who didn't have welding programs, where we brought our trailer into those schools and have provided training. We really believe that makes more sense than students come to us. Students do come to us. There's welding programs around the state. But the reality is a lot of students just don't see a pathway. And so we really believe we can give somebody the credential to get a welding skill to get them from unskilled to what we like to call one-up skill. And if we can get somebody a one-up skill, they can see a pathway to go on. But for many of them, that may be where they go and get into business, who then will train them or provide them other additional trainings. So we really see this as the future. We just, M-State just received a Department of Labor TAC grant through the Federal Department of Labor, and we're actually creating three additional mobile training units, one around precision manufacturing, one around CDL certification, where we'll put simulators in the back of a 53-foot semi, and one around construction and industrial safety, where we can teach all kinds of safeties on job sites and actually offer credentials. So, because in our mind, if we can go to the students, then we can serve the students. And we're going to serve that population now that is not coming, that's either not finishing high school, and or if they do finish high school, they're not coming to post-secondary education today. So that's really the group we're trying to serve. I think the Northland Project is a great project. I know Lakes Country Service Cooperative in our area, we work with them. We work with NJPA over in the to the east of us a little bit. Service Cooperative, I know Lakes Country has a similar program where they're wanting to create these. Their trailers are more around the scheme of equipment that can be moved to these schools, these small rural schools that just don't have the welding or mechatronics or equipment. And to, we have to show these students a pathway, and we have to make this simple. This isn't rocket science. So let's help them connect the dots. There's good jobs out there in Minnesota. They pay well. They have good benefits. So if we can show them, that student that may not want to finish school, not a button seat learner, if we can show them a pathway and we can say with their hands that they can get a good job in their local area and stay in their local area, then that really makes sense. And so we support working with these groups. We work with high schools. We work with Lakes Country. We work with NJPA and obviously Northland, partner with anybody around the state. But we really feel this is the only way to, or one of the ways, and we feel the most economical way is to try to go to those students, not wait for them to come to us. So answering questions, our mobile welding crew has been extremely successful. We've offered very high-end certifications, and we've taken people with no welding skill, zero, up to a 1G certification. And when you do that, you take a $12 person and make them $16 an hour, $17, $18 an hour up in our area. And let's be honest about this. The math doesn't work for this business if they can't afford to hire everybody out of Alex Tech's welding program, out of Northland's welding program. They can't. They need a lot of $16 and $18 welders. They don't need everybody at $25 and $30. And so that's why these things work, and to give them a skill and a one-up skill for those people that want to do it.
Great. I recognize that a couple of you have to go to another hearing. Any questions, comments from committee members? I think we share your enthusiasm, and we will include this for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill. Clearly, it's going to create jobs. And many of us are aware there's hiring bonuses, you know, in many communities if you're a welder. So you're tapping on a need. Thank you.
And I'm sorry we had to leave so soon.
No, we appreciate your visiting and sharing.
Sure.
Hey, Senator Sumpf,
we have two other people that I'd like to have come up here. And as they come up, I don't know if you have this information or not, but this was some information that Murray Turner put together. In northwestern Minnesota, we have over 866 manufacturing firms, and that accounts for about 27,000 jobs. So about one out of every eight people are involved, their employment is in manufacturing. And so it really demonstrates the need for training of the kind that has been proposed. So maybe I'll turn it over to Mr. Turner, and I kind of took some of his information, but I
that's fine.
Mr. Turner. Welcome, Mr. Turner.
Murray Turner, Director of Pine to Prairie Cooperative Center. So it was kind of interesting. We just listened to the CTE survey, and we were talking about career and tech programs, and you'll notice the top programs up there, manufacturing was never mentioned. And that's the way it is in the northwest part of our state. We do not have manufacturing programs anymore because of the cost of the programs and because of the lack of teachers. Now, if you remember, last Friday I testified on our online college and the high school program. Through that program, we have a 16-credit manufacturing credential, and it's offered through Bemidji State's 360 degree program, and that's for juniors and seniors. Our problem is we cannot get students interested in taking that manufacturing credential. The enrollment in those classes or courses are very low, or sometimes we have to cancel them. So our idea is we've got to get the students earlier and build a desire and an interest to take manufacturing classes. So that's our idea here, rather than try to equip teachers and equipment in all 29 of the school districts I work with. Mm-hmm. Let's put together mobile manufacturing and welding labs and bring those out to the schools. So I'll just finish here. There was a quote by the Minnesota Manufacturing Business. It says, with the resurgence of manufacturing in northwest Minnesota and optimism for continued growth, demand for workers will only increase. And this comes from Minnesota Manufacturing. To meet this demand, a number of steps can be implemented, including exposing high school students to careers in manufacturing. Okay, and that's where the idea came from, and that's what we would like to do if this bill is included. Thank you. Mr. Castle.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. My name is Kerry Castle. I'm the Vice President for Academic and Student Affairs at Northland Community and Technical College, representing the East Grand Forks and Thief River Falls campuses, and a proud partner with the Pine to Prairie Consortium in this initiative. Northland is committed to serve all of our area students, our industry, and our businesses. We see that as our primary function, and we look for new and different ways to engage and grow our student base, but certainly serve our community and our region as well. And we see this opportunity as one of those that we are very, very pleased to be partner with. We understand and know that it's difficult in a rural area to go ahead and initiate a lot of programs at different high schools. And quite honestly, at college, it's difficult to build a program, get everybody to come at one time if they have never been exposed to these types of things before. And as Mr. Turner already mentioned, manufacturing is really picking up in this northwest area. We talk with the DigiKey, Arctic Cat, Polaris, Marvin Windows. We're working with the Philadelphia Macaroni Company as well to develop and partner with them ways that we can increase their employee base through our college. Obviously, you also heard our sister college, M-State, talk about engaging the students at the mid-level, 25 years old and older. But we believe also that this opportunity provides a separate pathway to bring those students in from high schools and get them engaged and exposed to these kinds of things early on. The two trailers that Mr. Turner mentioned earlier include a welding trailer, which will expose the kids to that, and it will also expose them to automated manufacturing in terms of sensors, controls, programmable systems, robotics, those kinds of things that they can see. And it'll be a great opportunity for them to see what their options are for the future, and if they choose to do so, come join us, because we're certainly happy to have them there. We look forward to working with all of our partners in that area, and I am open to your questions.
Thank you, Mr. Castle. Senator Johnson.
Mr. Chair, and to Mr. Castle, tell me a little bit about the number of female students that participate in these manufacturing opportunities.
Right now, our primary manufacturing area is the electronics technology program. We have a program called DigiKey University. We partner directly with DigiKey in Thief River Falls, and so they send students to us in the evenings, and we've graduated about 400 of them over the last several years. And I can't give you a specific number, but just on anecdotal data, we are certainly looking at least a third or better. So now, that's not typical. I think that if we take a look at the welding program, we have one female student in our welding program at this point.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Further questions from the committee? Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Senator Stumpf, this would be your proposal is a grant to the Pine to Prairie Intermediate School District? Yes,
it is.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Pratt. Yes, and okay. I think there's another follow-up question.
Yeah, there'll be a couple, if you don't mind, Mr. Chair.
Senator Pratt.
So how many students do we expect to be going through the mobile lab, and for how many days and for how long at, you know, at a time? Is that any of that been discussed?
Mr. Turner?
Mr. Chairman, Senator. Yes, it has. We're looking at... The allocation would go to the Pine to Prairie Cooperative Center, okay, and my office is in Red Lake Falls. It's District 985, but I serve 29 school districts in the very northwest corner of the state, all the way, if you're familiar with the state, from Lancaster to War Road, Roseau, and then all the way down to Halstead-Hendrum, which is down by Fargo, mm-hmm. and then over towards Bagley. So it's about 13,000 square miles. Okay, the idea... as we put this together, that the mobile lab would come into a district for approximately 5 to 6 weeks. And with our four mobile labs, then we could serve approximately 20 out of the 29 school districts each year. I'm looking at some of our school districts. Roseau School District, who partners with Roseau, has a very extensive manufacturing and welding lab. They would probably not utilize the services. And there's others like that. But I'm thinking probably 20 districts out of the 29 would utilize the services from my initial survey of who would be interested. And my idea is this is for students. When that lab comes in, 7 through 12. They may bring elementary students in just to tour the lab to generate some kind of interest. But basically, it would be used by students in 7 through 12. We hope to get them in there, 7th, 8th, and 9th graders, have that interest, and then as part of our online program, they can work on these college credit classes in manufacturing in their junior, senior year.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I guess I'm kind of looking at the funding aspect, and I'm sorry to get down in the weeds and some of the money. But when I think of PSEO, and we've got students kind of going off-site, the money follows them to that institution. Is there a thought that when the students are in your program, you're getting whatever allocation of the basic formula for that? It's almost like an off-site program on-site. In a lot of ways, and that's why I'm kind of wondering, is there some self-funding built into this and the grants to develop the program, or are we looking at completely new money without utilizing some of the trade-offs?
Yes. Whoever.
Through our online college and the high school program, that is all delivered online to the school district. The students stay in the school. We contract with the colleges that we participate with, so the school district keeps all of the state aid, and they pay a per credit fee for those students taking college classes. Okay, so as far as the manufacturing credits and that, the students would stay in the high school. Okay, and your other question, our idea is we're partnering with Northland. During the summer, we would bring our high school teachers in, train them at Northland in the manufacturing and welding, remembering this is only a career interest type class. We're not trying to make them experts in welding. These are simulators. So the high school students, when that lab comes in, the high school instructors then will use those mobile labs. So all of the state aid and everything will be...
Okay.
Will be
Senator Dames and then Senator Claussen, and then we will move on to the next bill. Senator
Claussen. Thank you, Madam Chair. I just had a question. You used a per credit fee that the school district pays. Is this like a concurrent enrollment up to $150 per registration? Could you just elaborate on that a little bit, please?
You'd identify yourself for the tape. Speak, please.
Murray Turner, Director of Pine to Prairie. Senator Claussen. Yes, they pay, and it's a lot. We have contracted with the colleges, so it's a lot less expensive than PSEO. Our per credit charge is $130 per credit. So for a three credit class, $390. And that's what we collect from the high schools and pay to the colleges.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Stump, do you have any closing remarks?
No, I think members have information about the project in your packets, and so yeah, I think
with that, then we will lay this bill over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members.
So we have Senator Dahl now on Senate File 489 and 490. Debt equalization.
Madam Chair, members, I am back with some more recommendations from the facilities working group, and you remember my bill a few weeks ago, which took on recommendation number one for long-term maintenance needs, deferred maintenance needs, and so this is a couple of other recommendations. So I'll just remind you of some of the guiding principles of the task force, although I do have the chairs here and hope I don't take on too much of their thunder here, but some of the principles that were laid out in the task force that they mentioned were, and I'll just name a couple of them, that property tax levies for facilities should be equalized in a manner that minimizes variations in revenue per student to comparable tax effort regardless of variations in local tax base and provide stability over time. And you're going to hear from some schools in the C, Schools for Equity and Education districts, which several, most of my schools are in the C collaboration. And number six was a special provision should be made to ensure adequacy and equity for districts that have incurred facilities damage due to natural disasters. The two bills that we have before you, Senate File 489 and 490, I'm going to just start with the big view of, I'm going to go to 490 first because that was recommendation number two, and I'll read the recommendation to you, and I basically had a bill drafted that took on the recommendation, but Senate File 490's recommendation for the task force said to improve the debt service equalization formula by increasing the portion of debt service revenue that is eligible for equalization, restoring the state share of equalized revenue, and indexing future equalization to maintain stability in state and local shares of revenue. And so the bill basically does two things, or lowers the threshold for debt service equalization from 15.74% down to 10% of anticipated net tax capacity. And then it replaces the two-tier debt equalization formula with a single tier based on 125% of the state average of ANTC. And if you really want to get into the weeds on that, Mr. Arneson and Mr. Willems will be glad to explain school funding for you a little bit. The rationalization for that, again, on 490, is the state share of debt service revenue has declined from 11.3% in fiscal year 1995 to 3.1% in 2015. And currently, 80% of all debt service revenue is below the threshold to even qualify for equalization. And so we need a stronger state commitment to debt service equalization so that all districts have adequate access to equitable, sustainable funding for major facilities projects, regardless of their tax base. Senate File 489, and that is recommendation number six from the task force, says provide enhanced debt service equalization to address unique situations of needs. And a couple of major points of the bill would to replace the current facilities grant program under Minnesota statutes section 123A.44 with enhanced debt service equalization for certain districts with unique needs. Districts eligible for enhanced debt service equalization would include a district that has experienced a natural disaster that qualifies for FEMA with damages of $500,000 or more. A group of districts that are consolidating or recently consolidated needs to build or remodel facilities as part of their consolidation plan. And finally, a district that has debt service tax rate after regular debt service equalization that exceeds 30% of ANTC. So, again, the rationale from the task force that no grants have been issued under the facilities grant program since 1994. It's expensive, cumbersome, doesn't provide ongoing equitable solutions for districts with unique facility needs. So this enhanced debt equalization approach would target funding to districts with clearly established unique needs and spread the cost over the life of the project. So, again, addressing some of the needier lower tax-based districts. So that is just a general overview of 489 and 490. And I have the co-chairs of the facilities working groups here. I'm so glad that they were able to come in today. And I think, I don't know which one of you'd like to go first, but let introduce yourself. Yes.
Yes, Chair Johnson, thank you very much, and Senators. I am Mark Bollinger. I'm one of the co-chairs of the State School Facilities Finance Working Group, along with my colleague Bob Endahar, which you'll hear in a minute. I do thank you for coming out. It's these kinds of days that really put a stress on our buildings. And those buildings that we're not able to keep up with, the deferred maintenance and things like that, which we're talking about here in essence, is what we'll see this morning. We'll see tomorrow morning and other times when there's stress on the buildings themselves. The working group was formed from the 2013 omnibus bill. It consisted of 16 members that represented school district boards, superintendents, business managers, facilities directors, and members selected by the state school commissioner, of which I was one. We had three ex officio members from the legislature on there, Representative Quam, Representative Seltzer, and Senator Stump, and three members of the MDE that sat with us, including Tom Melcher. I know Tom Melcher, and I am no Tom Melcher. So if you do have questions about finance and accounting, I defer to our intelligent gentleman in the back of the room.
Mr. Bollinger, can you give us the dates when the working group was?
Yes, we met between August of 2013 through January of 2014. We finalized our eight recommendations and presented them in March of 2014. And I appreciate the this committee because two of our recommendations went on that very next year and was passed. One of them we're going to expand on a little bit, I hope, in this one. I would say that we did develop a total of eight recommendations. We created them so that they were individual. They could be passed individually or once passed as a group, they really did reform all of school facilities financing. We appreciate your support on that. I'm from Minneapolis Public Schools. I'm the executive director there of facilities. And so some of these do not necessarily affect me directly, but let me say that they do affect me personally and all of those that we represent because it's for the good of the kids. And that's why we're here, and we look out for those from one corner of the state to the other. We understand that there are issues in tax levies and the different property values, and we're hopeful that we're able to put something forth that helped all of those school districts take care of their buildings for just such days as today. Senate Bill Senate Filing 489, if you would, I'm going to repeat just a little bit. Was to provide enhanced debt service equalization to address unique situations or needs. There was some discussion of that and some passage of that last time on the natural disasters and focusing in a little bit, talking about consolidations. You'll see the changes in there for that. The beauty of that is that it does add some incentive, if you would, to be more effective, more efficient for some of the districts to consolidate, if at all possible. The rationale that was given, hopefully, will that all districts would meet the qualifications then to be able to participate if they believe that would best benefit their communities. Senate Filing 490 was our recommendation number two. That is really does address the improved debt service equalization formula. As Senator Dalton suggested or said read, the beauty of this is that it does lower the threshold for the debt equalization to 10% of the NTC And it does replace the two-tier debt service equalization formula to a single tier based on 125% of the state average. So we don't have to come back in front of you all the time. This will automatically correct itself as time goes along and then provide the best service for the school districts. So with that, I'm going to turn this over and introduce to you Superintendent Bob Indahar from Moose Lake.
Thank you, Mr. Indahar.
Thank you, Chair. I'm Bob Indahar, Superintendent at Moose Lake, and Mark Bollinger did a good job of explaining, so I'll be a little bit briefer on mine. What I wanted to explain to you is that the committee was put together with such a diverse group. I think they did a good job putting this together. As co-chairs, it's kind of funny because Mark and I talk a little bit about how different our schools are and what the different problems are. So we appreciate the fact that this problem that we've got with facility finance doesn't have an easy solution because there's such a diverse need out there throughout the state. But we worked off the premise of developing a facility finance solution that was adequate, equitable, and sustainable, and we always talked about that. We also talked about being realistic because what we're talking about here would consume a lot of money if we were to do everything that needed to be done. And so you'll notice that on some of the recommendations, it's tiered in over a number of years. It is a big problem. It's not a small problem. And I think we did a pretty good job of attaining our goal with the time that we had. Again, we had 8 recommendations. I appreciate Senator Dahl in the fact that he's bringing this forward because this is a big issue throughout the state. The debt equalization is something that I know that you know. There's a huge inequity there as far as what people pay throughout the state. What I would like to focus on perhaps, though, is the other recommendation, Senate File 489, which was the natural disaster. I think you renamed it,
unique situations.
Yeah. Moose Lake was in one of those unique situations, so I can testify to the fact that this language is effective. Our bond went down by 2-1 last time. This time it passed. We were the school in the state that went through the flood here a couple of years ago. So, again, I thank this committee before. I will thank them again. It made a difference in Moose Lake. So the language is good language. What it does is it expands it to 2 other categories, to consolidated districts or districts that are going to consolidate. I think that's good practice. Philosophically, I think it's a good thing to do to offer a carrot and not a stick, because politically and emotionally, it's tough to consolidate schools. And so if you say, well, if you do it, this is the carrot, I think you're going to see that you can get more schools to consolidate. And then the other part of it is that for schools that have really obnoxiously low property tax bases, you give them hope. So just wanted to say that, again, that I appreciate Senator Dahl's efforts in trying to get some of these recommendations that our committee had on the docket passed.
I have one question for you, Mr. Indahar. Yeah. Did it require a large amount of education for the public to pass that referendum? I really congratulate you for making that happen, however you did it.
Yeah. Chair Johnson, yes, it did take a lot of education, and it, to be honest with you, we had to tell, people were like, no, we can't believe we're getting this. And so we had to kind of get past that hurdle. And once we got past that hurdle, it was very easy. Our slogan was 60% off. And just to give you an idea, you may say, well, geez, Moose Lake, you got 60% off. That should have been a piece of cake. Cloquet just passed their bond for a little bit more than ours. They still pay less than we paid. But let me tell you, we're happy as heck. You know what? What we're trying to do is get closer to being equitable here. Hmm. So it worked.
Thank you. Senator Claussen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Indahar, when when you had that disaster, I'm just curious, what percent of your loss was covered by insurance?
Okay.
Mr. Indeher.
Senator Claussen, Chair Johnson, very little, as a matter of fact. When you go through a flood, you don't get insurance. We had things like, I think we had $870,000 worth of damage, and say about $50,000 was covered. It was like football pads on the floor. There were some weird things where we were able to get insurance, but typically, when you go through a flood, you don't. It's not covered by insurance. We now have to buy flood insurance, however.
Thank you. Any other questions?
Just a follow-up question.
Senator Claussen.
Mr. Indeher, then, what was your bond amount that you went through and passed?
Okay. Senator Claussen, Chair Johnson, the bond that we had was for a new pre-K-12, and it was for $34.5
million. Thank you. Any other questions, members? If not, Senator Dahl?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thanks to my initial testifiers. I have a few more here. Well,
yes.
Ms. Belcastro and Brad Lundell, I believe, are next, unless he's deferring to the next on the list. But I noticed some of you looking at the runs here that were created. And if you have any questions, Mr. Arneson said he would be glad to go over that. But if no questions on the runs itself or how to read those, we'll continue on with our testifiers. Okay.
Ms. Yes. Yes.
Which one would you like to go? Right here?
Sure.
Sounds good. Go ahead.
Good morning. I'm Kim Belcastro, superintendent of the Renshaw Schools, and thank you for allowing me to be here and try to speak to some of the concerns from some of the small districts in the state. And I'm honored to be able to be here, so thank
Superintendent,
you.
Superintendent, in case anyone is like me, tell me exactly where Renshaw is.
Renshaw is near Duluth.
Okay.
I was going to say that because I figured you wondered where it was. It's a small district with 330 students, PK-12. And why I was asked to be here is because the Renshaw School District is in serious consolidation talks with the Carleton School District, which is 4 miles away. And Carleton has approximately 450 students. And what I'm finding is that it's incredibly difficult, even though it might seem like it's a no-brainer to consolidate, it's incredibly difficult to bring the two communities together to agree upon consolidating. And therefore, with the information and with the two, particularly 489, the piece of it that is helpful, at least, is, you know, we can give the community some hope that there is some financial incentive out there if we can come together and consolidate our districts, and if we, even if we just add on, there is some support, or if we go brand new, there's even more support. And so that has been helpful, and we have talked about it a lot. The big thing is that in the communities, they'll say, well, how do you know? How do you know that we'll be able to get the funding? I hear that all the time. They wonder, why are we talking, you know, we want to know for sure if we're going to be able to get the money, and everything is a process to go through and to take them through. So I just can't say enough how much we appreciate the opportunities here in the event if we're able to consolidate, and why we have decrease in enrollment. We need to expand opportunities for students in these small schools, and to also, by bringing the schools together, you know, helping the state by the amount of money that is spent also.
Thank you. Where would the school be sited if you do get approval from your voters?
It will be at either of our current sites and probably an addition on to either of. And we're getting to the final decisions February 23rd, we're going to know how things
are going to turn out. It's very close. Yep, we're getting there. So thank you.
Thank you. Any question? Well, we'll finish the testimony first.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Brad Lundell with Schools for Equity and Education. Glad to be here today to talk about a program that's been very, very important to Schools for Equity and Education for over the last, since its inception in 1979. This is an area where tax policy and education policy meet. And I think it's very important that we always try to balance the discussion here with the discussion that's going to have to take place in the tax committee as well. We're all about tax fairness, and we're all about knowing that buildings are central to the product, the educational product, children, and making sure the taxpayers in low property wealth areas are not expected to pay more in terms of tax effort for those buildings. The debt service is somewhat complicated, more complicated, I think, than referendum equalization.
Excuse me, Mr. Lundell, would you pull the microphone over toward yourself a little bit? You're going in and out.
I'm going in and out.
Yes.
Which would you rather have me go, in or out?
I want you in. I want you in.
Take a poll right now. We think that the comprehensive approach here that we really want to commend Senator Dahl for coming in with Senate File 76, and now 49 and 490 to talk about a comprehensive approach to school facilities as what came through the working group discussions. And debt service equalization, which was established in 1991, is central, I think, to that discussion. We certainly want to commend him as we move forward. I think that if you look at pages from that report that was issued last year, you'll see that in 2003, the equalizing factor was approximately 150% of the state average ANTC. That has fallen to about 60% of the state average ANTC, and that's a lot to do with property inflation and certain types of property and things like that we've seen. That property per student, property wealth per student, has kind of gone up, while the equalizing factors have not. The equalizing factor has not kept pace. We certainly think that the indexing of the equalizing factor is very, very important. There's movable parts here with the threshold and the equalizing factor, but there are so many districts that I can talk about examples over the years, and I think that the gentleman from Moose Lake talked about it. You promise X percent on when you pass, when you go out to the voter and say the state is going to pay X percent of this. And when the equalizing factor is not indexed, all of a sudden that becomes X minus, X minus, X minus, all the way down to zero. And so I think it's very, very important that we look at not only the short term, but that promise that's made to taxpayers and keeping that promise moving forward. Dr. Craig Schultz from Mora couldn't join us today. Something came up, but I am joined today by Terry Preisler, who's the superintendent of the Tri-City United School District. She can give you an example of things that are happening in her district and how this bill, both of these bills, would be very helpful to her and the Tri-City United District. So thank you.
Ms. Pressler, Superintendent Pressler.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Terry Preisler, and I am the superintendent of Tri-City United School District 2905, which is inclusive of the communities of LaCenter, Montgomery, and Lonsdale, and the surrounding area. We are located about an hour south of the Twin Cities and are on the opposite side of the consolidation discussion as my colleague. I wish you luck. We are a newly consolidated school district, and in our third year as TCU, our district is 225 square miles geographically and encompasses about a little over 12,000 in total population. I'm here to testify in support of Senate File 489 and 490 for multiple reasons. First, the extreme overall challenge of passing bond referendums in the first place. Two, the improvements that we have made as a result of becoming a new district and the enrollment growth that we are experiencing and buildings already being beyond capacity. And finally, the need for tax fairness and equity for low property wealth districts. Prior to consolidation, the high schools within the LaCenter and Montgomery Lonsdale school districts dated back to 1936 and 1935. Each had multiple additions built on, but were in poor educational shape with students walking around buckets on rainy days, inadequate ventilation, and simply lack of access to some parts of the building on certain times of the weather. Families were leaving the districts, in particularly the Montgomery-Lonsdale district, citing poor facilities as the main reason. After many tries and eventually a bond levy that became reduced enough to gain voter approval, an elementary school in one of the districts was renovated and added onto to create a new high school. And it was at that point that the two districts envisioned the potential of the education we could provide for our students by combining together with increased course offerings, increased rigor at all levels due to recommitting to curriculum reviews and training of staff, and, of course, efficiency of resources. In our first 3 years as Tri-City United School District, our pre-K through grade 12 enrollment has grown from 1,900 to well over 2,000, and with a quarter of that growth being at our high school level, which is very exciting. We are just conducting an enrollment projection study as well as facility capacity study already, and within 4 years we are projected to grow by another 100 plus students, with, again, over half of those being at our high school. For the first time in years, our communities are experiencing enrollment growth rather than declining enrollment. And this is because of both the improvements to facilities and the expansion of programs from college in the schools to engineering, career technical education courses, and to inclusive programming to bringing back our students with high-level special education needs into our district rather than sending to specialized programs. As challenging as consolidation is and can be, we are an example of the benefits to student opportunities that can come with consolidation. And we are also an example that we are already beyond our capacity at our high school and are approaching 118% capacity. All indications show that we need additional classrooms plus science labs and art labs, which is used completely the entire day and with no teacher planning areas. I've only focused on our high school, but the broader picture is that we have another building over capacity, which needs additional classroom spaces or class sizes as high as 36 in fifth and sixth grade, which is not educationally sound. And finally, we have yet another building that has extensive deferred maintenance needs with leaking roofs, ventilation systems, HVAC repairs, and updates. Yes, that is the previous high school in our La Center community, which dates back to 1936. With a combination of a building and maintenance bond or the alternative facilities funding, which Senator Dahl has proposed, which is another important bill for our district, it will be extremely challenging to begin addressing these needs. Even Senate File 489 could be a benefit, even though we are already consolidated, if there were provisions for needed expansion due to consolidation, which is what we're experiencing. In order for us to even have a chance at passing a bond referendum to address the building additions and repairs, we will need to have tax fairness and equity. With the current debt service equalization, taxpayers at Tri-City United significantly pay more than others for the same dollar amount to build or to add on to a building. Our current debt equalization is at approximately 21% in Tier 2 and nothing for Tier 1. We are in the bottom half of school districts in Minnesota for equalization. So in essence, taxpayers at Tri-City United will pay $79 on $100 as compared with a district of comparable size paying only $33. We have been frugal and responsible with our taxpayers' investments in our district, and our Minnesota Constitution indicates a responsibility to establish a general and uniform system of public schools. In the event that I need to reach out to our voters throughout Tri-City United School District and as other districts who are in similar low property wealth situations, we need to do so with a plan that is fair to our taxpayers, no matter where a district is located in our great state. Senate File 489 and 490 could be a part of addressing these tax fairness situations. I thank you for your attention, and I'm willing to answer any questions.
Members, any questions? Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm particularly interested in Senate File 489 and the consolidation piece. I guess I'm trying to understand the problem. If you have bonds outstanding and you consolidate, the bonds get consolidated into the new district. Is that correct? And so is it that because you combined your property wealth went above and beyond the thresholds that would otherwise exist? I'm trying to figure out what you lost in the consolidation and why.
Superintendent Priceler.
Madam Chair, Senator Pratt, within the consolidation, of course, bonds that were in existence did come together. Some stayed within the previous district rather than going across the board, and we had the situation where Montgomery Lonsdale had previous bond, of course, the one voter-approved right before consolidation. The previous district of LaCenter had operating levy, and so combined in that piece. In essence, the challenge of low property wealth was in the situation prior to consolidation. Where our situation comes now as well is that even though we are expanded, we are still at a low property wealth school district level, and in order for us to consider or be able to act to move forward with any further additional classrooms or that, it will be extremely difficult just because of the very low equalization. I was not the superintendent at the time prior to consolidation, so some of those aspects of your bond question, Senator Pratt, may be ones that I could further research and let you know as well.
Well, maybe just a follow-up or clarification. I guess what I'm trying to figure out is what are we trying to accomplish in 489 that's not being accomplished in 490, where equalization is being provided to a lot to more districts at 125%.
Superintendent, or is anyone else?
I may want to allow Senator Dahl to answer that one.
That would be for the senator.
Well, I'll have Mr. Arneson address that one. We're going to pass the mic.
Madam Chair and Senator Pratt.
Well, good. I'm glad it's a difficult question. I feel better about
it's
myself.
Just practice for our staff.
Madam Chair and Senator Pratt, with particular respect to your question about what, how are the bills different in the event of a consolidation? So Senate File 490 would provide kind of general equalization increases across the board to any debt service revenue that exceeds 10% of ANTC. Senate File 489 sets that threshold also at 10%, but for these districts that meet one of those three criteria, natural disaster, consolidation, or very, very high equalized levy rates, the equalization factor is 300% of ANTC, whereas in 490, the more general bill, the equalization rate is 125% of ANTC. So the 490 generates, on a state average, roughly, what's in the run, I think it's about 15% of debt service revenues would be received in the form of aid. Obviously, with a 300% equalizing factor, the percent generated as aid would be significantly higher.
And
Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sorry. I'm still... We can follow up with this offline, Senator Dahl. I'm still confused as to what specific need to consolidated districts we're trying to overcome versus debt equalization overall, and what makes these consolidations unique that you have to be funded at, you know, a level that's more than twice what we've been talking, you know, what's in 490. So. I'm happy to take that offline or have somebody answer it.
Senator Dahl and members, just because of time, if we have a brief question from Senator Jensen, but otherwise we have Senator Saxhog's bill to complete.
Okay.
It's been very informative. I appreciate your testimony, Senator Jensen.
Well, Madam Chair, I just want to address it just quickly because the one bill is about unique situations. And when you have the property wealth in these particular areas that you're not able to pass the building referendums that you need, you're starting in a consolidation usually with very, very old buildings. So to be able to consolidate and create what you're trying to do and offer to the students in a consolidated effort, you're still not going to be able to have enough wealth to create a new building that's going to house everybody. And when you're consolidating, you're adding more students automatically. So it is a unique situation. It's almost like a regular school district all of a sudden doubles in size. So it is a unique situation that I believe needs to be put into a unique situation bill to try to address that particular situation that most districts would never have to face if they're not consolidating.
Senator Dahl.
And that's why Senator Jensen's a co-author of this bill.
Do you want to say one more thing?
Just simply to add, Madam Chair, Senator Pratt and Senator Jensen, I think that your question, Senator Pratt, in some aspects was addressed in some of the comments from my colleague as well. It is extremely challenging to consolidate school districts. Mm-hmm. There is a loss as much as there is a gain. And in the end, our students gain. In cases, our communities feel that some have lost. And so having the unique situation and financial supports to be able to build facilities that the entire consolidated district can, A, provide the opportunities that you're promising to your students, and also, B, to deliver on a new beginning does make it a unique situation, and in those cases does require some additional funding to that level. So it is, as my colleague indicated, to be able to say that there is some gains to this is very important in order to even have communities consider something to the level of consolidation. And we know that that is something that gets discussed throughout our state in various areas with financial means being short. Thank you.
And members, I believe in due respect to Senator Sagtog, I think we should finish this bill. Appreciate your testimony. I have some questions, but I'll talk to Brad about them and get the answers, hopefully, and maybe others can do that, too. With that, I would say that this bill will be laid over for consideration in the omnibus.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
St. Francis and Centennial. Members, my question was, the increase in the enrollment. I was impressed by the increase in enrollment in that consolidated school, and I was curious about that. Senator Sagtog.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair and members. Today I'm presenting Senate File 471. This bill would provide Lake Country Service Cooperative with $570,000 for the fiscal year 16-17 time frame to expand career, technical, and STEM education opportunities to students in the district served by this service co-op. That would be 13 school districts, and they've already expressed interest in participating in the program, and these districts are listed on page 9 of your handout. I guess I just say in my comments, which are traditionally short, is that when Sagtog goes out and talks to the sometimes to the school districts, he ends up saying the C word sometimes pretty often. That can be consolidation, as we just heard of, or collaboration. And I believe that this is an excellent collaboration that we're going to be talking about. With me today is Warren Schmidt, superintendent of the Rossay Schools, Richard Osmond, teacher from Campbell Tinta, and Cody Whiting, a student at Cromwell Wright High School, as well as Elroy Vesta, president of EJ Enterprises in Fergus Falls. They're each going to give a brief description, help answer any questions the committee may have, and with that, I'm going to turn it over to Warren.
Thank you.
Superintendent Schmidt.
Thank you, Chair Johnson and committee members. Good morning. My name is Warren Schmidt. I'm superintendent of schools at Rossay, Minnesota. I'd like to thank the members of the Education Committee for allowing me to address the committee concerning the benefits of Senate File 471. The birth of this idea came as a result of my frustration with not being able to offer students the ability to explore the various vocational opportunities that exist today due to budget constraints, time constraints, and equipment. The Rossay Public School has a capital outlay budget of $100,000. A welding simulator can cost between $47,000 and $50,000. Thus, the purchase of one piece of equipment is approximately 50% of my total budget for the entire year. A small school district would find it very difficult, if not impossible, to offer any type of STEM curriculum when one piece of equipment equals 50% of the entire budget. Since the equipment cost of a welding simulator is approximately $47,000, when used by 10 to 20 students, the cost is very exuberant. However, when sharing with 8 schools using 10 to 20 students, we now have a utilization of 80 to 160 students having the opportunity to share a welding simulator. The sharing process will reduce the cost substantially. Time is another great restraint. In the past, small schools have bused their students to vo-tech centers, industry locations, and larger schools. In RASE, and most schools immediately surrounding the RASE system, we are approximately an hour away from a large attendance center. Thus, RASE is 40 miles from Moorhead and 20 miles from Fergus Falls. It takes a student approximately an hour to get onto the bus, get their stuff out of their locker, travel down the road to the center, be there 1 hour, come back, is another hour, so they've missed 3 classes at school to get 1 hour. As a result, we find it very difficult to get students to do this. Whereas with the sharing program, I think that we can reduce that substantially. Plus, all our high school scheduling is then centered around 10 students, whereas if we get to this point of sharing, we can reduce that and have that in a one-hour block. RASE has also attempted to teach a class without a piece of equipment. That's very hard, very difficult. Students lose interest very quickly. The idea of sharing came to me after visiting the Campbell Tintoff, a neighboring school district. They belong to the Southeast Region Career and Technical Center in North Dakota. My travels took me to Wahpeton, where I met Dr. Rood, the president of that consortium there. Today we have 15 schools committed to the project. 3 more schools will be making presentation to their boards of education within the next month. Therefore, I believe we'll be able to have 16 participants. The basic plan, the basic premise of the plan is to provide students with an opportunity to explore 8 vocational experiences using appropriate equipment at a cost that is affordable for each district. The first year fee would be $5,000 for each participating school. It's the goal of the program that the fees be used for repair and for the purchase of additional equipment that will offer a more diversified program than what is being proposed, such as being proposed like drone technology. This will be a 4-year experiment and will cost the state of Minnesota $570,000, or 53% of the total cost. The participating schools will contribute $496,000, or 47% of the cost. In return, students from 16 participating schools will have an opportunity to explore the various vocational endeavors and hopefully make them aware of choices that pay well without the price tag of a college education. I am available for any questions that you might have.
Thank you, Superintendent Schmidt. We'll go through the testifiers first, okay? So you can speak, whoever, Richard Osman, do you want to go as they're in line?
I can go next. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Elroy Vesta, owner and president of EJ Enterprises in Fergus Falls. Our company provides print and promotional products. For 2 decades, I've been a part of TSMA, Tri-State Manufacturing Association of Manufacturers and Support Companies in the region. Our mission is to provide training, networking, and support to our communities. Toward that end, in the last decade plus, we have provided scholarships to students whose parents work at one of our member companies, especially for students that are seeking to enter and encourage them to enter into the manufacturing industry. In addition to that, we've begun to encourage school involvement with manufacturers by inviting schools, tech ed instructors to bring students and the superintendent of schools to be part of our monthly meetings where we tour manufacturers and students get involved with hands-on experience of encountering the workplace and meeting with business owners and others. By means of grants, we have sought to provide assistance to schools who need equipment updates. We've heard about that here already this morning. TSMA supports with money and partnership many robotics programs in our region. Tri-State is not just the only manufacturing association in Greater Minnesota. About 15 years ago, we stepped back and said there was a group of manufacturers in the Duluth area. They, together with us, joined together, and together we created MMA, which is Midwest Manufacturing Association. So Tri-State partnered with AMFA, Arrowhead Manufacturing Association. A few years later, a group from the central part of the state in the St. Cloud area, CMMA, joined us. And just this last year, Brainerd Lakes has an association of manufacturers that meet in partnership with their chamber in the region. So these associations, and especially Tri-State, have sought to involve students and parents in the understanding the manufacturing community through tours, supportive robotics programs. And at our board meeting planning session last week, our number one goal is workforce development, where we will continue to collaborate on innovative projects focused on increasing the number of people interested in careers in manufacturing. We know that we need to inform adults that manufacturing is not dingy and dirty. We hold out the idea that manufacturing has good jobs which require skills and in the end provide a good living. And in our part of the state, even better. Lakes and woods are nearby for fishing, hunting, and some sports activities. Educational development is not just a word in our region, it's a commitment, and we believe that this bill will enable that process to move more quickly. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Vesta, and I would say that, you know, good jobs along with your lakes and fish will keep the population in the rural Minnesota, which we all want. It's greater Minnesota, I should say. Senator Saxhog, who would you like to speak next?
My name is Richard Hosman, and excuse me here for my cold. I'm with the Campbell Tinta Schools, and I was asked to come up and explain this program that we put together about 7-8 years ago. And
Mr. Osmond, so Campbell Tinta is not in Minnesota. Correct.
Yes, it is.
It is.
We're
in
the proud city of Campbell, Minnesota.
Okay. Looking at the list of districts. That's why I didn't see you on here.
Yeah, we are right on the border, and we're just south of Wahpeton.
Okay. Thank you.
And Breckenridge. So, anyway, this program that we put together is a combined effort with the state of North Dakota. We work with the Vocational Technical Center that he just talked about out of Wahpeton, and our parent background supporter is out of Oaks, North Dakota. And the program that we put together combines a number of modules. We've got about 15 of them. And each module comes out, and we rotate them amongst 22 other different school districts. This is how we can afford this equipment. To bring a $22,000 U-print 3D printer into the program, we share it on a six-week rotational basis with the other schools. And that cuts our costs down. We actually pay about $3,000 a year to be part of this program with the other schools in the consortium. That barely pays for the consumables. So we've got a pretty neat program going on here, and with the use of this and enough money coming in, we are able to continuously upgrade and even come up with new programs. I'm going back on Thursday, and we are going to talk about this new drone program that they've got for monitoring crop in the agricultural end. I'm not even sure what it's all about, but it's pretty exciting from what I'm hearing, and the kids all know about it, which is always what I'm finding in this program, is I'm always, what are you talking about here? So we're trying to keep up. I'm the only career and tech ed teacher we have left in Campbell. At one time, we had four. And right now, we offer more programs than we ever did when we had four teachers. Because of the uniqueness of this program and how the diversity is, I can bring in more now than I was able, or you know, we were able to do as a group years ago. So I'm doing everything I possibly can to get kids hands-on to the latest equipment that is out there and it's available. I'm unique. I'm a value-added teacher. I had 20 years of industry. I came out of the manufacturing. I've got an architectural background. So my engineering side is what really drives this, and I'm able to bring stuff to kids that probably wouldn't be able to normally be able to see this stuff. Everything that we are using is high industrial grade engineering type programs. Fabricus, SolidWorks, ClarisWorks, 3D CAD. Everything is set up so that it is industry standard. So when I take my students out to these manufacturing terms, the students, hey, wow, we're using the same thing as what these industries are using, and these kids are saying, you know, maybe I could get a job in this. It's kind of neat to see what the kids are starting to do and see. We have over 12 different high-tech programs, and like I said, the six-week rotation, it gets the thing in and out. And the kids just start getting into it, and then we pull it out, and we bring in a new one in before they lose interest. And when I teach them the first year, then the kids are allowed to come back and use the equipment the next year. And what's fun is then the older kids that have learned it will come down and teach the younger kids. It makes it easy for me as a teacher. Now I'm sitting back, how can I help you? But the kids are in there engaging with each other and working on this and helping one another. So the teaching that's going on here is amongst the students. And when you can take something and learn a skill and you can transfer it to another person, what a tremendous thing to have as a background. And the kids feel so good about helping others. I sent some projects around that some of the kids did. The Little House, if you remember that one, that black one there, that was done by a sixth grade student, not even in my class. He saw what was going on, kept poking into the room, asked me one afternoon, can I come in and see what you're doing? So after school one day, we called his folks and said, if he wants to stay, I'll be glad to show him. Showed him a smaller CAD program that you can get online, how to work it, how to set it up. That kid went home that weekend, set that program up on his own computer, worked the entire weekend, and drew and designed up his own house. I couldn't believe it when I got it. When I pull up the bus at night when we drop the kid off, that house looks the same. It's got a fireplace on it. It's got the windows. It's got the doors correctly. I didn't even have to teach the kid. I just showed him how to get started on it in the program. The teachers are just amazed. He says, how come you have no homework, but more kids are doing homework in your class than anybody else? It's because the kids are doing it on their own when they're going home. I just wish we were able to be able to fund more money for software to get that to the kids, but we're working around it. We're finding things online now, and there are companies out there that are donating smaller portions of their programs because they want these kids to get engaged with it because they're hoping that in the future they can use these programs as an adult in the industry.
Mr. Osmond, you know, your testimony and okay. enthusiasm is very noticeable. I would hate to cut off our student, which is probably,
sure.
I would say, the most important person on your team.
Yep. Two other things I'd like to say. Girl retention is great. They love this program. It's the highest that we have in the program in years. Thank you. I appreciate it. If you've got any questions or anything, I'd be glad to tell you about the program.
Thank you. And now we'll listen and hear from Cody Whitting, our student. And he has some more props.
So, Madam Chair and members, Cody's from up in my neck of the woods, up in Arrowhead and Cromwell. Right. So,
thank you for telling me without me having to ask to show my lack of knowledge on these small school districts.
So, Cody, come on over here and give us a little run.
All right, so that drone right there, 100% my design. You cannot buy that anywhere. That is my design.
Your drone?
The drone, yes, it is flown.
I have to tell you that I happened to bring the Minneapolis paper today, and there's the cartoon on the editorial page has a picture of a drone and says, "Okay, well, how am I going to tip my drone for the delivery of the pizza?"
So they've got an app for that.
Get up, let me get my drone shout out there.
Cody, please.
All right, so the drone. I've made absolutely everything besides the battery, the motor, and the wires. I've used a software called SolidWorks. It's an advanced 3D programming. I've had 5 years of the class. It's the first year it was a struggle. Second year it was better. And from there on, it's been amazing. I love it. It's fantastic. It drives me to do something. I go to the class, wait for that hour all day long.
Well, that's great.
Then we also have 7th graders. They made a Legos robot that actually balances itself.
This one?
That one, yes. They programmed it themselves. They put it together from a kit that Lego sells. But they had to go online and research how to build it. It took them, I believe, 2 weeks. It was very cool to see that thing stand up on its own for 45 minutes. And we also have a plaque of the SolidWorks class of 2015, my graduating class. That took over 20 hours to print on our 3D printer. It's time consuming. But something that it's hard is having one 3D printer for 15 kids in a class. It's a bummer.
I'm digging this.
The things that I'm limited to are by the technology and equipment that I have. We don't have a CNC machine. We don't have a vertical mill. We have one 3D printer, 10 computers for 15 kids in a SolidWorks class. It's hard. But all this talk of drones and robotics and welding, it fascinates me. I walked in here and heard virtual welding, and I was like, I want one of those. Personally, I've actually used a virtual welder. I thought it was the best thing I've ever seen in my life. The advancements that it gives everyone, it's good. It drives someone to do work instead of sitting at home doing nothing.
I'm gathering that you do support this bill.
Oh, no.
It's wonderful to see such enthusiasm.
I mean, I don't really have much to say, but
it's great.
Besides that, I just love it.
With your enthusiasm and your demonstration of your work. Thank you very much.
So,
Senator Kiffmeyer has a question.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I think one of the things that stands out here, though, that I'm also seeing is the fact that you have a teacher that has real-world experience. Maybe not the technology is going there, but an inspiring teacher.
Yes. Our industrial teacher is the best teacher I've actually ever had in my entire life. He has done so much for the school. He's pushed for new technologies, pushed for new education. He actually, Mr. Bloom, makes me want to go to class every single day.
So, Madam Chair, I think there are some really wonderful people. And you know, we heard about before about the CTE certification and how that is a hindrance. And we have people out there who are experts in their field, who have a passionate heart to pass this on to the young kids. And what I see more than anything is the issues are the stumbling blocks that are put between them and their love for teaching and their love for encouraging and the students who we all have a passion for. And it seems to me that more often we set up roadblocks in those connections. This is one example where I can see, but sometimes, you know, necessity is the mother of invention. So sometimes it's okay to struggle a little bit. It's okay to have to share, because I assure you, in the private industry, you may have limited resources too, and you learn to get creative and learn how to work that through. That's actually also real life. But I think that for us as committee, I wish we would hear more of these sorts of things, but also from the sense of how can we get out of the way more and allow these things to happen instead of putting them in such a stricture that we actually become part of the actual problems we talk about. So here's a great example, both of the teaching side of it and what that can do and how we as a state can either fund this, that's wonderful, but I wonder about how many others would be more progressive if we just let them do more of this without all the issues that come between it.
It is a difficult balance sometimes, but thank you, Senator Kiffmeyer. Any other comments? Questions or comments you have about that?
If not, Madam Chair, I would ask that this bill be laid over for possible inclusion in the main bill.
The bill will be included. Be laid on the table.
Thank you very much.
Included in,
Madam Chair, members.
Thank you. Members, that concludes our testimony and our bills, and the meeting is adjourned.
I'll have you look at one.